Victory or death!
Victory or death! Victory or death! Victory or death! Victory or death! Victory or death! Victory or death! Victory or death! Victory or death! Victory or death!
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Radio Free Virginia. I'm your host, Hank Reardon, the voice of freedom behind enemy lines here in the Commonwealth of Virginia. This is episode 21-08, the eighth episode of 2021. And in today's episode, I'm going to be talking about some of the bills that have passed the House and the Senate and are on the way to our oath of a governor for final passage, signage, or vetoing. But before I talk about those things, let me talk about how you can listen to the podcast. You can use the Podbean Player, which is an app you can get for your Android or iPhone, and you can listen that way. You can go on the website, radiofreeva.com, and listen there, or you can listen at Podbean, radiofreeva.podbean.com. But you can find that link at Radio Free Virginia, radiofreeva.com. So please do me a favor and share this podcast. If you find something interesting you want others to know about, you find somebody that you think, I think my friend Bob would like this. It would help me. Help me help you. Help me to grow an audience. Also make sure you comment and like whenever you can in your preferred player. I did find a glitch, and I've been meaning to contact Podbean. Has a glitch in their player. When I'm listening to a podcast, even a downloaded podcast, because there are differences, you can it'll download as you're playing, or you can download it and then just play. I've been driving through a lot of rural areas this week and last week, and every time I would drive into one of these rural areas, the podcast would just kind of stop. Randomly stop. And some of them I listen to, there's these long pauses of the podcast contributor who's taking a pause for whatever reason. So I'm not really sure sometimes. I look over at the radio and I can just tell that it's not playing. Well, that's weird. Turn it off and on again, it starts playing. And this is because it's losing connection with the home app. I won't get into the technical details. I know why it's doing it. It's a flaw in their app. Because when I put the phone in airplane mode, that problem goes away. So it's when it's no longer trying to connect to the home base and update its records. Now I'm telling you the technical reason. Now it's updating. It's trying to update where you're at in this. So that if you were to log in on the website and play the same thing, it would know right where you are in that podcast. So you can just continue on in your not using your app. And so that's a flaw. I don't know if that happens in iPhone, but it's happening in the Android app. So something they need to fix, and they might not even know it's a problem. So I've been meaning to send them a message and say, hey, fix your junk. All right, so one of the bills that hasn't yet passed is HB 2312, marijuana legalization. And so I'm gonna bring in Philip. He's my worthless brother, and he's going to talk about this bill. Whoa, brah, that's like a harsh introduction. You know, I'm not worthless. I just like to relax and have a good time. So let me look at this bill, HB 2312, marijuana legalization, retail sales penalties. Oh, harsh word, man. Eliminates criminal penalties for simple possession of marijuana. Awesome. Modifies several other criminal penalties related to marijuana. Go MJ, and provides for an automatic expungement process for those convicted of certain marijuana-related crimes to have such crimes automatically expunged by July 1st, 2026. Bruh, what's the word expunged mean?
It means to make go away, to erase.
Righteous. The bill creates the Virginia Cannabis Control Authority. Oh man, they're switching one authority for another. Look out, everybody. And establishes regulatory structure for the cultivation, manufacture, wholesale, and retail sale of marijuana. Awesome. So you mean I can go to the store and buy the stuff?
Yeah, that's the deal, Philip. That's exactly what this is saying.
Sweet.
So there you have it. There's a new take on HB 2312, which hasn't yet passed because the Senate and the House can't agree on something. But I fully anticipate this passing because, you know, why not? You know, I've been saying for years, we're going to lose this fight. We might as well get something for it. We're getting nothing for it. And it's going to pass anyway. My concern overall is the stench. It's bad enough when somebody's smoking a cigarette on their porch outdoors next door to you. I can smell that. Doesn't matter which way the wind is blowing. I know I can smell it. So it's much, much worse with the smell of marijuana. But, you know, here's where we're at. I was driving to Norfolk this week for work and smelt this funny smell. I don't recognize that smell. What is that? It stinks. And I thought, man, I'm near the coast. Maybe it's just some stinky water or something. No. It dawned on me what it was. The car in front of me, the guy was blazing up and getting high in his car. And I'm pretty sure there's not an exemption in this new bill for driving your car under the influence. But I always used to make fun of these cop shows. You'd watch it and they'd pull somebody over and say, well, you know, I smell a strong smell of marijuana. And I look at the boys and I'm like, yeah, right. Come on. But it's noticeable. And there's been numerous instances, and almost always it's up in that part of the state. When I'm up in Virginia Beach or Norfolk, I was at a park next to a vehicle. I think I've even talked about this. And I smelled the smell. And I've never used marijuana, but I know what it smells like. I know people that have, and I've been around others that have, and so it just doesn't happen often. Lately, it happens often up in the coastal area of our state. And then on the way home, the same thing happened. Different car. I'm driving along, and there's that smell again. It was the car in front of me. Guy was getting high while he drives. Ridiculous. So the bill hasn't passed. That is HB 2312. Has not yet passed both the House and the Senate. But you can bet it probably will. And one of the things it creates is the Virginia Cannabis Control Authority, kind of like the ABC. And establishes the regulatory structure for the cultivation, manufacture, wholesale, and retail sale of retail marijuana and retail marijuana products to be administered by the authority. Now, I don't know if that means you can set up a store and they're going to regulate it. You know, the ABC sells the alcohol in their stores. In many other states, they just regulate it and they have liquor stores, or you can buy it at Walmart or whatever. But in our state, they actually have a store where they sell the alcohol and reap the rewards of that. You notice we don't get any tax breaks because we make all this money selling booze. But in any case, we don't know yet what the final outlook will be, what this will be, and how they will incorporate and through conference committee deal with their differences. And if it'll end up getting killed, who knows? My prediction is it will pass. Well, I'd like to thank Acticare of the Blue Ridge, ACTIKARE.com/blue-ridge. Acticare of the Blue Ridge provides in-home senior care for your loved one when you can't be there. Whether you're in Smith Mountain Lake, Roanoke, Bedford, Campbell, out in the country, give them a call and talk to John and his staff and see how they can help you take care of someone you love and do a good job doing it. They genuinely care. He's got a hard worker, hard working staff, and
So you should give them, get in touch with them, ACTIKARE.com/blue-ridge. And thank them for sponsoring Radio Free Virginia. A couple other bills that have passed is HB 2042. This is a tree replacement conservation during development requirement. Gives them the ability to exceed the general requirement regarding replacement of trees, which, I mean, I've never actually seen that be a real thing here. Not in the central part of the state. We have so many trees, and when they come in and they develop an area, they just scrape everything off, develop it, and almost never replace even a hint of what was there before. So I don't know what the actual requirement is. Maybe it's almost nothing. And this gives the locality the ability to say, you must plant this type of tree or that type of tree. I don't know. So they did pass the one about lengthening the time that the state police have to process a background check. HB 2128 was passed. I fully anticipate this to be signed by our oaf of a governor. Sale or transfer of firearms criminal history record information check delay. So it increases from 3 business days to 5 business days. I've talked about this previously. And that just means more delays when you're going, when a person is going to purchase a firearm. Normally, there is no delay. Normally, you walk in, fill out the paperwork. A few minutes later, you get it approved, and you walk out the door. But if you were somebody, let's say you're a woman who's in danger, and you need to get a gun, and there's a delay, you're not able to get that gun. All right, so this is Bumbles on Guns. And this is a statement by the usurper 3 years after the Parkland shooting. 3 years ago today, a lone gunman took the lives of 14 students and 3 educators, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. In seconds, the lives of dozens of families and the life of an American community were changed forever. I'm going to throw in some commentary as I go here. That wouldn't have happened had those educators done their job and dealt with that shooter before this happened, which they had numerous chances to do. For 3 years now, the Parkland families have spent birthdays and holidays without their loved ones. They've missed out on the experience of sending their children off to college or seeing them on their first job after high school. Like far too many families, they've had to bury pieces of their soul deep within the earth. Like far too many families, and indeed like our nation, they've been left to wonder whether things would ever be okay. I don't want to make light of the loss that these people have experienced, but this is some creative writing. Holy cow. These families are not alone. In big cities and small towns, in schools and shopping malls, in churches, mosques, synagogues, and temples, in movie theaters and concert halls, on city street corners that will never get a mention on the evening news, all across our nation, parents, spouses, children, siblings, and friends have known the pain of losing a loved one to gun violence. And in this season of so much loss, last year's historic increase to homicide across America, including the gun violence disproportionately devastating black and brown individuals in our cities, has added to the number of empty seats at our kitchen tables. Today, as we mourn with the Parkland community, we mourn for all those who have lost loved ones to gun violence. You lost people to violence, which is the natural human condition of fallen man. And as far as the black and brown individuals in our cities, they're killing each other. It isn't the gun doing this. They're doing this. And these are in the most liberal, gun-controlled states and cities across the country. Over these 3 years, the Parkland families have taught all of us something profound. Time and again, they have showed us how we can turn our grief into purpose to march, organize, build a strong, inclusive, and durable movement for change. What inclusive? Inclusive? What does that? What does inclusive have to do with your wanting to take my guns away? Oh, look, a trans person showed up to our protest. Hooray! Nobody cares. Nobody cares about your stupid trans people showing up to an anti-gun rally.
The Parkland students and so many other young people across the country have experienced gun violence and are carrying forward the history of the American journey. It is a history written by young people in each generation who challenge prevailing dogma to demand simple truth. We can do better, and we will. This is a statement by the president. I don't think the president knows what day it is, let alone anything about what's going on in the Parkland families.
This administration will not wait for the next mass shooting to heed that call. We will take action to end our epidemic of gun violence and make our schools and communities safer. Today, I'm calling on Congress to enact common sense gun law reforms, including requiring background checks on all gun sales, banning assault weapons and high-capacity magazines, and eliminating immunity for gun manufacturers who knowingly put weapons of war on our streets. We owe it to all those we've lost and to all those we've left behind to grieve to make a change. The time to act is now.
Ban assault weapons and high-capacity magazines. Universal background check, which is a registration of all firearms, because that doesn't work. Universal background checks don't work unless you have all the information. High-capacity magazines, that's standard capacity. My gun, my pistol, can hold 15 to 17 rounds, depending on the magazine. That's the standard capacity. My rifle has a 30-round magazine. It can hold 30 rounds. It is a standard 30-round capacity. Eliminating immunity for gun manufacturers who knowingly put weapons of war on our streets. What? How do... I'm sorry. The absurdity of this. I mean, clearly he didn't write this. It's too... It's got too much of a poetic flair to it. But weapons of war? Come on. Come on, man. The time to act is now. Well, they are acting. They're acting for sure. Yeah, this is ridiculous. I mean, I want them to pass these things. I do. You know why? Because the patriots in this country only understand when the boot is on their neck. That's the only thing they understand. The boot of tyranny is stomping down the street. It's marching. And yet, nothing's happening. Nobody's dealing with it. Nobody's responding. Eh, meh. Is the response that most people have. Meh, eh, whatever. No, not whatever. But yet, nothing changes. So I want them to go full retard. I want them to pass every nutty wackadoo thing so that Americans and patriots will stand up and go, wait a minute. Joe Biden was not elected the president. Donald Trump was. Donald Trump is the president in exile in Florida. But none of that matters. At the moment, this oaf, Bumbles, is hooked up to whatever machine he's in down in the basement. And someone else is running the show. And until we see that and see the... You see this is laced with communist propaganda here. I will never, ever, ever comply with any of this. And the day comes when I'm going to be a felon because of a hunk of metal or a piece of plastic that I own is the day that I'm going to be the best darn felon I can be. That's what patriots should be doing right now, is thinking about that. What happens when they make you a felon? What are you going to do about it? You're going to tell people, I don't know what happened, man. I've lost all those in a boating accident. I didn't lose anything. Time to go to work, boys. If that's where we're at, if they pass this stuff, if they push these through, that's where we're at. I'm not going to comply. Because you comply, the next step, 6 months, a year, 2 years down the road, they're loading you into a box car. They're putting you in a re-education camp. They're drone striking you.
all things they've talked about. Well, not the boxcar, but everything else. So wake up, America. Wake up, Virginians. This is what's coming. They're telegraphing what they're doing right in front of you. And you're still licking your wounds because you're mad they stole the election. Well, I'm mad. I think it's time to get to work.
In recognizing a communist, physical appearance counts for nothing. If he openly declares himself to be a communist, we take his word for it. If a person consistently reads and advocates the views expressed in a communist publication, he may be a communist. If a person supports organizations which reflect communist teachings, or organizations labeled communist by the Department of Justice, she may be a communist. If a person defends the activities of communist nations while consistently attacking the domestic and foreign policy of the United States, she may be a communist. If a person does all these things over a period of time, he must be a communist. But there are other communists who don't show their real faces, who work more silently.
Now we continue in the saga of Herbert Philbrick, the infiltrator of the Communist Party for the FBI. Chapter 11, Party Discipline Tightens. It was a thoroughly case-hardened communist who set out through the hot, sticky night of July 21, 1945, as an alternate delegate to the crucial convention of District 1, Communist Political Association, in downtown Boston. I crawled into my Marxist compartment, shut the door, and stayed there. This was a trick that 4 years of concentration had taught me. It would have been impossible for me to go so far in the party and still escape detection as a government agent if I had not been able to control my emotions and reactions, especially in an atmosphere such as that which pervaded the muggy, tense Saturday evening when the convention opened. Nevertheless, there were some chinks in the compartment. The July convention, we were told in advance, was a major turning point in the history of the party. It promised to be a hurly-burly, which would stretch my powers of self-control and credulity to the limit. If I was to be called on to play a role, I was not sure how I would play it. The question both the Bureau and I were seeking was yet unanswered. How far to the left would the party swing? What would be its program on a practical level from here on? Every comrade felt that until the new communist platform was set forth, it would be extremely dangerous for any individual to take a stand. I felt the same way and determined that until at least a partial answer was provided, I would stay in the background, keep faith with my party orders to function as a semi-underground member, observe what I could, and remain unobtrusive as possible. Most of the party meetings I had attended during the previous year, since the 1944 district convention, had been small gatherings. But now, the charter room and its foyers at the modern New England Mutual Life Insurance building on Berkeley Street were crowded with several hundred of the party's faithful. Mixing in large communist gatherings was a precarious occupation for me. I felt a cold fear that somehow, somewhere, there would be one member of the crowd who might put the finger on me. Even with two passes to the convention in my pocket, I was uneasy, and my very uneasiness made it worse, lest I give myself away by a display of nerves. The Bureau was anxious to have a full report of this convention, and I didn't want to be tripped up on the way in. I mingled with the crowd and descended to the downstairs lobby. Across the room, I saw Mark Alper's gimlet-eyed gate watchers at the door. I sought to avoid them. After I felt perfectly composed, I strolled over to the literature table, which was a perennial fixture at all party meetings and conventions. I engaged in light conversation with the literature attendants, whom I knew, and bought several books and pamphlets. The old party classics were there, dusted off and brought down from the high shelves where they had been for over a year. The History of the CPSUB, Imperialism, The Highest Stage of Capitalism by Lenin, Foundations of Leninism by Stalin, The Communist Manifesto by Marx. Routine party propaganda journals were there too. Stacks of The Worker, The Daily Worker, and the magazine Political Affairs. I asked for a copy of Socialism, Utopian and Scientific by Engels, but was told that it was sold out and I would have to wait until the Progressive Bookshop, the party propaganda center, received a new shipment. There was a tip-off to the nature of the convention on the literature table. Every work by the prolific pen of Earl Browder, his Victory and After, Teheran, and all the great books of the erstwhile hero of the Communist Political Association was missing. Up to this point, no vote of any kind had been made by the membership on the fate of Mr. Browder's leadership, yet it was obvious that the decision already had been made. At all previous meetings, Browder's books and pamphlets had occupied the forefront of every literature table. Now they were gone. His doctrine was already non grata in the party. I ran into several old friends in the hallway. Margot Clark, the girl who had put me to the test in my early days in Cambridge, was one of them. Whenever I saw Margot now, I felt a little flutter in the pit of my stomach. To me, her presence echoed the dread sound, KGB, the secret police. I had no definite proof that Margot was a member of the KGB or its United States counterpart, but I had enough circumstantial evidence to make me apprehensive and very cautious. For one thing, Margot was not a member of the state board, nor did she hold any party office. Yet, this slight, grave, and almost fragile young woman had an air of poise and competence that could not be missed by the party. She was given many important tasks, and on this occasion had the job of housing for the convention, which meant she must know not only the names and addresses of a great many of the comrades, but also some of the details of their family life, how much extra room they had to spare to take in others, who should be billeted with whom. There are very few comrades, even in the higher ranks, who ever get around enough to know the intimate details about large numbers of the membership. And those who do are prime candidates for the dreaded Review Commission, the party's undercover counter-spy ring. Margot seemed strangely involved in matters of party purging and discipline. I passed her by with a warm enough greeting, but I did not pause to get involved in conversation with her. I also ran into Don Ballin, now, like me, a former officer of the AYD. Elba Chase Nelson, the grandmotherly New Hampshire Yankee whom I had met in the 1944 convention. Phyllis Helene, one of the new officers of the nearly bankrupt AYD, and Arthur Korb, pianist-composer who had played at our Youth on Parade dinner. Finally, I spotted Fanny Hartman near the entrance door. I felt that it was an opportune moment to make my entrance. Walking up to Mark Alper's barricade, I handed in my alternate delegate card, greeted Fanny just inside at the same time, and unconcernedly engaged her in conversation while the clerks at the desk checked my card and its number against the long sheet of paper spread out in front of them. The sheets contained every name approved to attend the convention, like a voting list, together with the delegates' card numbers and other information. As each card was handed in, the name was crossed off a list to make sure that no one would get through the door on forged or duplicate cards. "This is a beautiful place to hold a convention," I said to Fanny. "Sure is," she returned. "Even the air conditioning works. Thank heaven." In the midst of these banalities, my card was handed back to me, and I passed through, fully accredited. I found the Malden delegation, about midway in the auditorium on the left side, seated at a large, bare table set up on sawhorse supports. Alice Mills was the principal delegate and the central figure of the group, which also included Frank Collier, and a Malden girl whose party name was Grace Smith, known to many simply as Comrade Grace. I pulled up a chair next to the wall where I could face outward and obtain a good view of the entire gathering. I was immediately conscious of the distinctly different atmosphere of the meeting. There was a buzz of efficient activity, but unlike the usual political convention, there was no turmoil. No buttonhole parlays were being held in corners, there was no lobbying around delegates' tables, nor was there any loud or boisterous conduct. Everyone was there for an assigned purpose. It reminded me of a newspaper city room, where each person has a job to do and knows exactly what is expected of him. The convention started with the Star Spangled Banner, a last remnant of Browderism, not yet obliterated. Anne Burlak, as president of the State Communist Political Association, gave the main report. Anne must have known that her number was up. Her address was a masterpiece of flagellation, in the best tradition of communist self-criticism. She had been wrong to embrace Browderism and realized it now, she said, and she was willing to assume full responsibility for leading the organization down the pathway of deviation. Anne offered to the convention the National Committee's draft resolution, based on the Duclos letter, and urged its adoption in full. She said that Comrade Browder had been guilty of the most grievous errors in developing a reliance on Monopoly Capital, which had sabotaged the vanguard role of the party. She said that she agreed in full with the Duclos letter, and she called for an immediate return of Marxist-Leninist policies and the reconstruction of the party. "This is the most important turning point in our history," her voice shrilled over the public address system. When her long, biting harangue was finished, it was Otis Hood's turn to carry out his previous orders and pull back from the pro-Browder role he had been called upon to assume in print. Now, in his speech, he merely quoted Browder without supporting him. But by this time, Browderism was thoroughly whipped, and no one would come forward to defend it. One planted speaker in the rear of the room read a watery letter from an unidentified comrade which sought to defend only certain minor parts of Browder's program. From there on, the convention got into full swing. It followed the familiar pattern of our first American Youth for Democracy meetings. Those who wished to speak sent their names to the chairman on cards furnished for the purpose. At the rostrum, the chairman, the post rotated for the various sessions, gravely sorted out the cards, and with equal gravity called upon those who had been previously approved as speakers. As an experiment, knowing that I had been assigned no role as a speaker, I submitted my name, and of course I was never called on. Alice Mills also sent up her name. I knew in advance what she would say, and the FBI already had an outline of her blast against capitalism. Coupled with her demand that the new party widen the gap and sharpen the conflict between the proletariat and the bourgeoisie, not to cover up the contradictions between them, as Browder had done. One after another, speakers rose to denounce the ways of Browder, in terms which occasionally went even beyond the limits predetermined by hierarchical policy. So far to the left did the pendulum swing that the meeting began to get out of hand. Only the card system for calling on speakers saved the day. The leadership tried to apply the brakes, but they were greeted with hoots and howls. One major issue was the National Committee's program for continued adherence to the wartime no-strike pledge given by the Communist Political Association. The United States, after all, was still at war with Japan, and the atom bomb end of the war was not yet in sight. But Russia was not involved in armed conflict with Japan, and strike action was the favorite communist weapon for dissension. The hate program, outlined by the preliminary speakers, worked too well. Hate, hate, hate reverberated around the room from wall to wall, ceiling to floor. The extreme left wing of the district organization jumped on the bandwagon. The roars of rage and hate were most vehement in one corner of the room, where I spotted the squat, flamboyant figure of Don Tormey, radical CIO, United Electrical Workers organizer. Tormey's communist-controlled faction of the UEW has since been expelled from the CIO. Tormey was a young, militant scrapper with 12 years of rough-and-tumble labor experience behind him. Now, he was red-faced, perspiring, his shirt sleeves rolled up, his tie askew at his open throat, clamoring for the floor. But he was not on the approved list of speakers and could not get a hearing. Nevertheless, from the storm center in this section of the auditorium, a full-scale revolt was in the making. Older comrades recalled the J. Lovestone battle many years before, when the party was split asunder. The district functionaries were worried, and with excellent reason. When the meeting finally broke up at a late hour, in an atmosphere of turmoil and exhaustion, not everyone went home. A secret midnight meeting was held at the little building offices to thrash out the procedure for the following day. I was not invited, but reports of the strategy meeting came to me by the grapevine. I made a hasty telephone report to the bureau. Then I went home to light the lamp on my own study, where I typed up a summary of the session for Hal Leary. Sunday morning's conference opened with an announcement, obviously the result of the previous night's strategy meeting, that several features of the program would be changed, and a series of panel discussions would be called off. It was apparent that the hate campaign would be soft-pedaled. The revolt against Browderism, instigated by the party leaders, had almost gotten out of control, and the blood pressures were still high. The morning session was a long wrangle, which lasted well beyond the noon deadline. Dave Bennett, sitting as chairman, proved an able conciliator to rampant charges and countercharges of Browderism and every other shade of deviation from Marxist principles. But the compromises did not entirely satisfy the extreme left wing. It was not until final Sunday session that Don Tormey managed to break through the barriers opposing him and gain the floor. Once he got it, nothing could stop him. He waved the red flag of disruption, confusion, and civil strife with the information that now was the time, following Marx's principles, to turn the imperialist war into a civil war and pave the way for revolution. Tormy urged rejection of the no-strike pledge in the proposed party platform and drew significant support to forestall routine adoption of the National Committee's program. His tirade included a blanket denunciation of the leaders and membership of the district for clinging to remnants of Browderism. The leadership was already beaten to an ideological pulp by the Tormy revolt. They needed a defense, and fortunately for me, it was Alice Gordon who rose to it. "First of all," she cried, "many of the policies which we followed were entirely proper and correct, in keeping with Marxism-Leninism. They were win-the-war policies which would and should have been followed even if Browder was not the leader of the party." Not only that, but Comrade Tormy, the membership was already back to the comrade salutation, "Comrade Tormy is incorrect in the blanket criticism of the entire membership. I know that some were not so easily diverted to Browder's views. It is well remembered that Comrade Herb of Malden, for example, held out to the very end and then only accepted the Browder program for the sake of party unity." I flushed and tried to crawl down into my coat collar. Fortunately, Alice had not gestured in my direction to single me out and thus damage the anonymity I coveted. My fellow comrades at the Malden table looked upon me with new regard. My cantankerous needling of the cell more than a year before on Beacon Hill came home to roost, and I knew now that the results would be advantageous to my party future and to the FBI. The draft resolution was offered to the convention section by section, and gradually the leadership stemmed the tide of the left-wing revolt, but not without compromise. Some of the opposition was allayed temporarily by coupling with the no-strike pledge a demand that employer provocations of labor disputes must be stopped. Fanny Hartman proposed further study for issues that remained in dispute. It was a narrow victory for the party leadership. Exhaustion and the National Committee's program, at least its substance, finally won out. Late in the evening, V.J. Jerome, a member of the National Committee, stifled the audience with a speech that was so long and so vacillating that few listened to it and no one remembered it. It served its purpose. Delegates began drifting out. The convention broke up, subject to recall, August 11th and 12th, after the National Convention in New York. My 20-page typewritten report to the FBI required several late evenings of work. I sent in a list of names which, I was surprised to find, included nearly 100 of the 300 persons attending the convention. I also sent literature, pamphlets, and voting lists together with a summary of the full convention in an effort to analyze where the party was heading and how far it was going to go. I concluded from the convention proceedings and from the debate I had heard that if Russia came into the war against Japan, then the party would string along with the nation's war effort. But if Russia should disavow any military interest in the Far East, the party's attitude would be sharply changed. And a new war against American imperialism would begin with obstructionist fervor on the home front. The advent of the atom bomb and Russia's hasty entry into the war against Japan just before the armistice solved that problem for the comrades. And soon as the war was over, American imperialism did replace Japanese fascism as the party's prime target. After the convention, I attended a series of meetings at party headquarters to discuss the details of the August session. I asked Ann Burlack, "What will we take up?" "For one thing," she flashed with a vehement glance, "you may be sure that we will discuss the matter of party discipline." I felt uncomfortable, wondering whether she was thinking of Don Tormy or of me. "Under the new program, we will have to know where our members stand." "Good," I said, trying to suppress the involuntary flush, which I always felt stealing over me at times like this, and which I knew was my worst security flaw. "It's about time." Before the August meeting came around, Don Tormy was severely reprimanded for his left-wing revolt. He was put on the blacklist, which merely meant that he was given no assignments. The Tormy incident emphasized the tightening of party discipline. No one, not even an arch-revolutionary, was permitted to deviate from the policy laid down by the National Committee. My own ranking with the district leadership rose a notch or two as a result of Alice Gordon's reminder that I had been from the beginning a reluctant Browderite. A few days prior to the August convention, I was assigned to work with Alice to set the membership of the Malden branch in the new line and to pave the way once again for the convention deliberations. A series of special branch meetings was called, and I was designated as the lead-off speaker. Frank Collier mailed out the notices. He assured me that it would be perfectly safe for me to talk freely in addressing those present because the notices were going only to bona fide and trusted members of the party. Many of my old friends from the Wakefield cell turned up at the meeting, and I was a little surprised to find that so many of them had successfully weathered the violent attacks from the party to the association and back to the party again, from comrade to brother and sister, and now once more back to comrade. But there were also several new faces on hand, following what had now become standard procedure. No introductions were made, if any identification was used at all. It was invariably by first names, real or assumed. A few could not conceal their identity. One of those I picked out of the crowd at first of our meetings was Harry Winner, the widely known and influential Malden businessman, who as a teacher in the Sam Adams School for Social Studies had assisted in the Marxism indoctrination for prospective young communists in the AYD. I was surprised at Winner's presence because of Collier's assurance that the meeting notices would go only to highly trusted members. Winner was an enigmatic figure. I could not bring myself to understand his position. A prosperous business executive, well-liked and respected in his community and business life, yet apparently active as a secret member of the Communist Party. He was one of the many among the membership who remained aloof. Unlike the avowed communists who could approach each other freely and openly, at least at party conclaves, I understood that I must shun him, in and out of the party. It occurred to me also to wonder from time to time what his role was. If I were a member of the Communist Review Commission, I thought that I would automatically suspect Harry Winner as a secret government agent. But perhaps I was overestimating the man. After all, I was one of the very limited number who had proof that the government had infiltrated the party. And then again, I reflected, Winner was, like Margot Clark, just the type who might, without too much stretch of the imagination, be a member of the Review Commission itself. The new party, in its disciplinary ardor, was becoming nervous about security. Mutual suspicion cut through all ranks from the top down. In mid-August, the reconvened sessions of the District 1 Convention were held at the same place, with the same delegates and alternates. The checking and double-checking of credentials were more intensive than ever, and the guards at the door were more formidable. But I was a part of the convention now, and I came and went at ease. The convention itself was a dull, routine affair, which merely rubber-stamped the New York reconstruction of the party and listened to an artful, inspirational address by Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, the big, jolly, powerful, oratorical whip of the party. Miss Flynn's harangue was what the convention needed. Her magnificent sense of timing, her accurate measure of the temper and response of the audience, roused them to the only enthusiasm of the two-day meeting. Browder was dead. Long live Foster. Comrade Flynn's colorful history in American radical movements dates back to her close association with the famous socialist leader Eugene V. Debs and with labor leader Big Bill Haywood in the early years of the 20th century. She was later indicted as a second-string communist leader on charges similar to those against the original 12. A new district board was elected, with responsibility to initiate a fresh and intensive program for agitation, recruitment, training, and dues collection. But the most important aspect of the August convention, from my point of view, was a report by Justine O'Connor, a vice president of the state committee and member of the state board. She proclaimed the edicts for the toughening exercises of the party on an educational level and called for the setting up of a state educational commission to carry out an elaborate program of training in Marxism-Leninism. She stressed the need for a series of Marxist training classes for all cadres of the party, the preparation of study outlines and pamphlets delineating the new and more vigorous party policies, an active cultural group, and the training of new teachers to carry the message to the rank and file. I was almost exhausted, mentally and physically, from the fever of activity in the summer of 1945. Communist Party affairs had been especially demanding, and, of course, I had to keep them secret from business associates. The intensification of security measures within the party kept me on edge. My long nights of filing reports to the Bureau robbed me of sleep. To complicate things further, the Eighth War loan drive of the entertainment industry was in full swing, and as usual, Harry Browning's office served as the headquarters for the New England War Activities Committee. The coming of fall promised no slackening of things to do. Shortly after Labor Day, and on the pile of morning mail and work on my desk, I found one message which told me cryptically that I was to get in touch with the FBI quickly. I placed the call, and I learned that it required one of our personal contacts, which by this time had become exceedingly rare, and then very devious. I avoided the FBI headquarters as much as possible, going out of my way on crosstown trips so that I never came within 2 blocks of the building. In order to be doubly careful, I purposely avoided curbstone conversations with any business or social acquaintance who might possibly look to prying eyes like an FBI agent. The contact was set up. I left the office a few minutes before the appointed time, headed across Scolle Square toward the Suffolk Savings Bank at the far end. Along the side of the square, a man fell into step with me. "Hello." It was Comrade Roy, a newcomer, possibly a party underling or recent district floater, whom I had encountered at the state office, but whose mission I did not know. Whatever it was, I did not want him with me now, and had to shake him quickly. I returned his greeting without slackening my pace. I glanced at my watch and noticed that my FBI contact was less than a minute away. I looked over my left shoulder and saw that the bureau, as usual, was on time. Comrade Roy and I strode across Pemberton Square to the corner cigar stand, where I paused and decided to make the plunge. "I'm being picked up by a friend," I said, stepping to the corner and raising my hand in signal to the car heading through the square. The automobile bore a single distinctive marking, which no one would notice unless he was looking for it. "Sorry to duck off, Roy, but I have a business appointment uptown. You know how it is. Oh, could I give you a lift?" I added, with a perfect confidence that I could if he wanted it. "No thanks," he replied. "Just going up the block a step. So long." I climbed into the car and closed the door. The driver turned to face me with a barely perceptible smile, which indicated that everything was all right. "Head down to Park and out Beacon Street," I said. Then I sat back until we had passed the Parker House and left Comrade Roy in our wake. My contact in the driver's seat, a bureau agent whose name I was never told, spoke up. "There's an envelope down behind the seat," he said, turning up Park Street. "Take a look." I fished for the envelope and came up with it. Inside, I found a passport-type photograph of a heavily jowled middle-aged woman. "Ever see her before?" asked the agent. I examined the picture carefully. "Nope, not in this area." "What level is she?" "High." "Who is she?" "Probably be known by the name Helen," the agent answered. I searched both the picture and my recollection for a clue. "I know 2 Comrade Helens, but this doesn't look like either one of them." "Okay," said the agent, with a trace of disappointment in his voice. "If you do run into her, let us know. Name is Elizabeth Bentley." "What's doing?" he added with an offhand tone, as if to change the subject. I knew that he would have no more to say about the Bentley woman. "Plenty," I replied. "Right now we're lining up what the rank and file will be digesting this winter. Who's running it?" "For the young members, the Bennetts. For the adults, Fanny Hartman. Tell how the party is getting suspicious of everybody. I can't be too careful." The agent drove me across the Charles River to the Central Square Theater, where he stopped and let me out. "Sorry I couldn't help you," I said, standing beside him for a moment to go through the motions of saying goodbye to a friend, just in case I'd been followed. Pondering over the woman in the photograph and wondering why the Bureau was so anxious to have information about her, I returned to the office by a roundabout route after a routine call on the theater manager and cleared away the work on my desk as rapidly as possible. Then I got in touch with party headquarters. From the very first meeting of the reconstituted Communist Party, the new spirit of grim militancy was in evidence. All the leadership received explicit instructions. There will be a tightening of the party cell and club network. Each leader will be responsible to the district executive and will take orders from him. Iron discipline will prevail throughout. I learned at district headquarters that a highly secret training class for a dozen or so carefully selected candidates for party teaching posts was in the offing, and that I was on the list, which was then being carefully screened through with every agency of the party. The purpose of the class would be to train teachers, who would in turn go out to cells in the network, to break down the new party line into its component parts and define a course of action for the membership. I also learned that despite my close affiliation with the headquarters and the district leaders, I was even then undergoing renewed scrutiny by the Review Commission. The commission never considered a case to be closed, whether the party member was a lowly grubber or one of the top brass. Evidently, the commission was busy. Browderite deviationists were being frozen out of the party in wholesale lots. They received no more notice of meetings, no assignments, no party communications. for comrades who were thoroughly imbued with communism, in spite of their deviation, it was harsh treatment. They felt a psychological amputation, which was mentally painful to them, more so than an outright expulsion under direct charges. Under these conditions, it was not unusual for the victims to become so distraught that their families and friends became fearful of suicide. The new security drive gave the district party from top to bottom a severe case of the jitters. Naturally, I did not know all of the ramifications of the screenings through which I was going, but it dropped into my ear that the review commission was on my trail, possibly in expectation that if anything was wrong, my nervousness might betray me. The party's security consciousness was given its deepest shock when, on October 10, 1945, Louis Badens abruptly announced his resignation as managing director of the Daily Worker, his renunciation of communism, and his return to the Catholic Church. The uneasiness of the membership turned into cold rage. This was treason in high places. The rank-and-file members had already been fed the treason of Earl Browder. This was perhaps the first time in party history when the ordinary members looked askance at their leaders. Suspicion was rampant. If a top member of the national organization could be a traitor, so could an officer of the district organization or a branch leader. The shock gave credence to Don Tormey's argument that the evil spirit of Browder still lingered in the hearts of some of the party functionaries. Self-criticism was no answer to this problem. A hard and vicious counterattack was decreed. New efforts were ordered to quell once and for all any criticism of national or local leaders within the party. I attended one secret meeting for discussion of the Badens affair. Our speaker was unknown to us. Comrade Sam was his only name. He was plainly in a belligerent mood. "We have no reason to cover up the Badens' betrayal," he told us as we huddled in the warmth of a small dingy room under the glare of a single overhead lamp. Who was Badens? From the very beginning, his background was sinful and treacherous. He was an underling who wormed his way into positions of leadership for his own profit. Badens, Comrade Sam said with an air of stern warning, was incorrectly promoted without sufficient testing. The main lesson we have learned is that we are not only surrounded by the class enemy. The enemy's agents are at work within our ranks too. We will find them out. His emphatic pause fell on a moment of intense silence. Comrade Sam's face was cruelly etched with the slanting glare of the single electric lamp. The pause punctuated by the measuring breathing of 20 men and women in the room. Everyone stared straight at the speaker, or the wall behind him, not daring to steal a glance at his neighbor. While I felt an intense discomfort, as if the eyes of the person behind me were drilling through my head, I knew that I was not alone, that everyone in the room, whatever his position in the party or his motives in being there, was uneasy. The speaker let his glance roam around the room. "The party must and will act ruthlessly," he went on slowly, after pausing almost after every word. "From top to bottom, the review commission will root out and destroy the agents of the enemy who smuggle themselves into our ranks. We will overlook nothing. There are many in the party who, like Badens, are not innocent. That does not mean that all comrades will be disciplined for connections with the class enemy in the past. So long as his past has been repudiated and the comrades have proved themselves in the struggle, it does not mean that all comrades must be doubly conscious of their past." The speaker continued with the usual discourse about discipline, the elimination of weaklings, and the necessity of building a strong, tough party ready for any struggle. We were more relaxed by the time he had finished, but when the meeting broke up, no one had much to say to anyone else. From that time on, the name Badens was seldom heard in the party. Nothing too much jumps out at me here. It's clear they're still dropping the hammer on the way things had shifted, and he has still established himself in the past as a solid, good old Bolshevik, and so that's really helping as time goes on here, and as things are kind of tightening, they're tightening their grip, the central party. Now that Russia has defeated the Nazis, thanks to us, they're able to set their sights back on America, and they're getting their hands in everything that's going on. This one thing jumped out at me. I flushed and tried to crawl down into my coat collar. Fortunately, Alice had not gestured in my direction to single me out and thus damage the anonymity I coveted. My fellow comrades at the Malden table looked upon me with new regard. My cantankerous needling of the cell, more than a year before on Beacon Hill, came home to roost, and I knew now that the results would be advantageous to my party future and to the FBI. So while that was done, which secured his position as a solid Bolshevik, you know, that was done really to poke fun at the party people. And it's coming back to really work out really well for him with the way things have shifted. And we'll see. What's fascinating to me as we get on in the other chapters is that he starts to bump into people that he never would have expected were communists. And he climbs higher and higher and higher, and they never suspect Comrade Herb. He does such a good job. So it's always interesting to me when a man like that and others, I've known others that can be duplicitous. And in this case, he's doing it to get information. He's a patriot, and he's infiltrating this organization. But there are plenty of others who aren't patriots that are infiltrating our organizations, whether it's the militia or the GOP or whatever. You name the organization, your church. And these people, these duplicitous people, get involved, and they are there to basically cause problems. They're on the other side. In this case, what Herb does is he kind of has this routine that he goes through in his head of how to shut down the non-communist in him and become the communist. So that's how he's able to continually not be caught. Pretty impressive. I don't have that. I've known people that have it. I don't have it. I knew this guy, and he used to get me so spun up because he could turn it around and immediately, with the flip of a switch, become a leftist and just go on and on and on with all this leftist tripe. And I would get more spun up, and then it would dawn on me what he was doing, and he would laugh, and I would look at him and I thought, you did it to me again. But there are people that have that ability, and Herb's one of those. Well, and it's going to wrap it up here. I'll keep you up to date about what's going on in Richmond and Washington. No news yet on our president in exile. And there's still people that think, oh, it's still going to work itself out. The Supreme Court this and the Supreme Court that. I wish that were so. I hope I'm wrong. I hope it does. I hope that works out. I'd like to remind you that you were not made to fit in. You were born to stand out. I'm Hank Reardon. This is Radio Free Virginia. God bless you.